This is an Envoice Media podcast.
Today's podcast is going to be a little spooky. I like to think of all these things as little manipulation games. We're going to talk about this interesting phenomenon that comes up out of psychology and neuroscience. A lot of times we behave first.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then afterwards we make up a story. What kind of influence you're trying to generate, right? You have to find the ways of putting these different pieces together. We're going to talk about alien hand syndrome.
You're listening to Manipulation Games Psychology and Marketing Podcast with your hosts, Gene and Darren.
Welcome to Manipulation Games Psychology and Marketing Podcast. I'm Darren with our marketing expert, Gene Alder.
Hey, guys.
Welcome back. This is technically, I guess, our second episode?
Second or third episode, if you count the kind of initial Fool's Journey episode.
Episode zero. Yeah. I loved our last episode about glamour. If you guys haven't checked it out, I learned so much just from listening to you defining what glamour was. I mean, I actually started like changing my own behavior about how to be glamorous. I started being like mysterious, looking off in the distance.
it's interesting because as soon as you become aware of some of these things, right? Uh-huh. Initially, a lot of these things like glamour, charisma, cool, attractiveness, you know, like social magnetism. A lot of these things seem like something magical and kind of out of control, right? But once you kind of start breaking them down, you can find little formulas, little things that you can actually start implementing.
Yeah.
And that's why I like to think of all these things as little manipulation games.
Yes.
Because as soon as you actually learn the rules, then you can play the game.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's, again, kind of in your own personal life, whether it's in business, whether it's in marketing on a mass level,
yeah,
you start finding like, oh, these are the buttons I can press.
No, I love it because I started pushing those buttons, creating all these like glamour ads.
Yeah.
For, like, fun and practice. And it's kind of addictive because it's like, oh, look at me. I'm the mastermind behind, you know, all these social media posts. I'm going to get people to like start dreaming and about allure and attracting people who want to chase that dream. I learned so much from that podcast. So thank you, Gene.
That's awesome. No, I'm glad you're putting it into practice.
So like, I want to talk about this episode.
Yeah.
Because again, I feel like our podcast, you know, we should always like, I want people to always take something out from us, for every single episode. I don't want people to miss, you know, nuggets of wisdom that we can learn. So what is this podcast going to be about?
Okay. So today's podcast is going to be a little spooky.
Ooh.
We're going to talk about alien hand syndrome.
Alien hand syndrome.
Right. And how alien hand syndrome can, in a lot of ways, kind of help us understand ourselves a little bit better.
Uh-huh.
And then potentially understand others, right?
Wow. Okay.
And then be able to have more influence.
Now, for those who don't know what alien hand syndrome, what can you explain what that is?
Okay. So alien hand syndrome is this interesting phenomenon that comes up out of psychology and kind of neuroscience, where there are certain cases where people have very, very, very severe epilepsy.
Mm.
And historically, especially before there were drugs to be able to help with epilepsy, people were kind of looking at ways of being able to help people cope with it. And when epilepsy happens, one way to describe it is it's like an electrical storm that kind of goes through your brain. And so it starts off and it's like a domino effect. And all of a sudden, it's like firing all these neurons in your brain, literally like a storm.
Uh-huh.
And people essentially pass out, they have seizures, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And so at one point in time, I guess, one of the procedures that was developed to try to help people with epilepsy is they realized that if you think about the brain, right, we have the kind of the big part of our brain. When people describe the left and right brain, it's usually when they're describing the kind of the top level brain where a lot of like the logic and pattern recognition and language lives. And what the procedure for the epilepsy that they developed was they realized that they could cut the two sides of the brain in half.
Yikes.
Right? Because interestingly enough, the two sides of the brain are not connected with that much tissue. There's some tissue there called the corpus callosum.
Wait, they actually did this?
Like they do the surgical procedure.
Oh my God.
On a number of, again, very like severe cases of epilepsy. And the idea is that if you can cut the corpus callosum and sort of separate the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, you can at least restrict this electrical storm that happens during epilepsy to one side of the brain. And then the other side wouldn't be as affected.
So that's a theory.
No, well, I mean, it works. Wow. It's an extreme solution, uh-huh. right? And I believe they still sometimes do it in like very extreme situations.
Wow.
Obviously, there's now medicines for epilepsy, but so the alien hand syndrome comes into play yeah. with this, that after the kind of the doctors end up severing the corpus callosum, uh-huh. the connection between the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, yeah. and the patient wakes up, there have been situations where very strange things have started happening.
Wow.
Where the two sides of the brain start acting entirely independently of each other. And the way you initially notice it, right, uh-huh. is usually your left side of the brain controls your right side of the body. Uh-huh. And the right side of the brain controls the left side uh-huh. of the body. And since most people are right-handed uh-huh. and we have most of our kind of language on the left side, uh-huh. One of the hands starts acting out and doing
itself.
Things. Yeah, doing things by itself. So what happens is that usually the dominant side of the brain, the uh-huh. one that tends to have the language, tends to continue, I guess, being the part of the consciousness
oh.
that is us.
Uh-huh.
While the other one is sort of separated and the two sides of the brain aren't communicating, and all of a sudden one hand is starting to do things completely separate.
Oh
right?
my God. So it's almost like having two people in your own, on your own head.
Essentially, right.
Competing maybe for attention.
For attention, uh-huh. for a lot of different things. And so we'll circle back to how this applies to essentially manipulation games and marketing, yeah. right? But what this seems to indicate is that the thing that makes us look, one person, uh-huh. or at least the illusion that we are one person, is the fact that, you know, we have these different parts of our brain interconnected with each other and communicating to each other, mm. right? And if they're not connected to each other, we all of a sudden start acting, you know, we all of a sudden have like now competing minds mm. all on us, right? Mm-hmm. And so a couple of examples, like, so there was this, Roger Sperry was kind of the doctor who's working on a lot of this stuff. And there was like a patient, her name was Karen Byrne, mm-hmm. and some kind of like anecdotes of her experiences. She was talking about how she would light a cigarette. She would like balance it on an ashtray. Mm-hmm. And then while she wasn't looking, her left hand would take that cigarette and snub it out or like flick it off or throw it away, right?
Yeah.
Wow. There would be situations where like the alien hand in this case would uh-huh. like take things out of her handbag, right? She wouldn't realize it would happen. And then later on, she'd realize that these things are gone and she'd constantly be just losing things
uh-huh.
because for whatever reason, uh-huh. The alien hand, the other side of the brain that's not speaking, was communicating or acting out
wow.
right, by taking
wow.
stuff out, right?
Wow.
This is kind of a fun one, right? You know, her left hand would be buttoning a shirt uh-huh. while her right hand would be unbuttoning. And I guess there would be situations where potentially the right hand would start undressing.
Oh my God!
Her in inappropriate situations, right?
Imagine how frustrating that would be if you literally have two people competing for different kind of
yeah.
interests. You know, subconscious, maybe your non-dominant subconscious brain.
Yeah, but I mean, do you really have to imagine that? No, but I mean, if you
okay.
once you start thinking
right,
about it,
right. No, this
it's happening to us all the time.
No,
right?
that's what I want to get into
yeah.
is that like the marketing side of this, like this is real. There's a non-dominant hemisphere in your brain that is trying to communicate with your dominant side of your brain. Is that correct?
Well, that's one way, right? Mm-hmm. So like one of the big divides is we have the left brain, right brain divide, mm-hmm. right? But then there's also other ways you can sort of divide up the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the thing that when I first heard about this situation, I actually remember the moment. I was in my kitchen in Los Feliz, and I was listening to Sam Harris's book, Waking Up, mm-hmm. which is about consciousness,
oh, okay.
right?
Yeah.
Wonderful book. And he talks about this experiment because he's looking into the question of like, what is it to be a single consciousness? And when mm-hmm. you divide the brain, all of mm-hmm. a sudden there's like now two of you.
Uh-huh.
And for example, if one side of the brain decides to get rid of the other side of the brain, is that murder? And like all these like crazy questions, right?
Yeah.
But it made me start thinking about like, well, how does this like apply to our own behavior, right?
Uh-huh.
Are we really all like one brain?
Or are we all in control of our behavior? That's another question.
Yeah, we're not.
Oh,
so kind of to... give some a couple more anecdotes, but like one aspect of it is like, for example, in Karen Byrne's case, like sometimes her hand would slap her and be violent against
herself. Wow.
Right. And so if you start kind of thinking about, you know, the alien hand syndrome is kind of an extreme version of this situation. Mm-hmm. But if you start thinking about the corpus callosum as like as wires of communication between the left hand, left side of the brain and the right side of the brain, and you start thinking about how much bandwidth, like if you think about from a tech standpoint, mm-hmm. there is between the two sides of the brain, right? It's not as much as we think. Mm. So even when the two sides of the brain are connected,
I see.
Right? There's still not perfect sync.
Yeah, you're right.
Right. And so in the alien hand syndrome, it's a more extreme version of that, where like they're completely not talking to each other.
Right.
Right. But there's tons of situations where chances are there's parts of our brain in our day-to-day life, right, they're not communicating to each other.
Wow.
As efficiently as we imagine they're communicating.
That makes a lot of sense. So there's you're right, because the brain is like kind of two separate sides, but there's this little bridge gap. But you're saying that, you know, there's not a whole lot of bandwidth anyways. So there's a bottleneck.
And so there's a bottleneck.
There's a constant probably competition of, you know, signals that you're getting between two sides of your brain.
Right.
To do something that whether it's buttoning or unbuttoning or smoking a cigarette or not smoking a cigarette.
Yeah.
So then this is perfect, because then we can really, really dive into this and see how it affects consumer behavior.
Exactly. And we're definitely going to get into that. I want to lay down some of this groundwork. So, because once I heard about the alien hand syndrome, right, now every single time you're looking in different situations, you're asking about like, you know, what is like my alien hand doing, or what is the alien hand of the person you're trying to influence doing, right?
Uh-huh.
And so a personal example for me, where I have this kind of similar situation, where I'm a person who I would never order sweets, right? Yeah, or buy cake, or like go to the store, or like get candy. Uh-huh. It's not something like, I never crave it. I never want it, right? Uh-huh. But if you put me in a room with like a bowl of cookies, that bowl of cookies will disappear. See, I will eat all of it.
I love that analogy, because your logical side of your brain, right, is saying, no, that's not something I want to do.
Well, it's just like it's not even aware of it. It doesn't want it. It doesn't ask for it, right? But, so like a top level part of my brain, right? But clearly when I'm physically in the space with the food, right, there's probably a more primal, deeper side of the brain, right, that all of a sudden like takes over, because, you know, historically you loading up on calories is a really good thing for your survival. And so I've noticed that there's these situations in life where you go through, and you start noticing that when your behavior starts diverging from your intention, often that's probably because the different parts of your brain are disagreeing.
So right. That means we can actually catch when these moments happen.
Well, you start thinking about it, like,
yes,
you know,
and
a lot of times, you know, in life, as you go through life, you ask yourself, like, why did I do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Why did I do that?
Yeah.
And we beat ourselves up about it, right? Because oftentimes we think of ourselves as one unified entity.
Right.
But it kind of starts giving you leverage if you maybe start thinking about yourself as kind of these divided entities, and you might need to find ways of being able to get leverage on those other parts of yourself.
So you're saying that we can trick ourselves once you recognize the fact that, okay, there's two competing sides in my brain. You know, one is logical, one is just very impulsive. But then if you can understand those impulses of why you want to eat that cookie, you know, as opposed to, you know, not eating that cookie, then you can actually start even manipulating your own mind.
Manipulating your own mind, and then also potentially manipulating minds of others.
Oh, wow. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Please tell me more.
All right. So kind of lay the groundwork. So there's this thing called alien hand syndrome, or the split brain phenomenon, that basically shows us that essentially the different parts of our brain can be competing against each other. Mm. One of the interesting things that kind of came out of that, that is also kind of useful, is that there will be situations, right, where you can show one eye certain information while not showing the other eye information, right? So in a split brain situation, since they're not communicating to each other, you can show information to one side of the brain. And the other side of the brain will be oblivious to it and not know about it, right? And certain things would happen where, like, for example, you'd be able to give the instruction to the non-dominant side of the brain to tell somebody to get up and, like, walk across the room, right?
Whoa.
And this is where this kind of applies, I think, to influencer marketing. The person will get up and walk across the room, but then when you ask them why did they do that, they would make up a story, a story that makes sense to them of why they did that. So what that seems to indicate is that a lot of times we behave first.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then afterwards we make up a story that makes sense to us for why we did that.
So this is something that I think we're probably going to really get into is how or why people make these decisions.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, and I think just talking to you beforehand, talking about how people make decisions based off their emotions, and then they justify it with logic after they make that decision.
Yeah.
So is that something we want to get into?
No, yeah, that's exactly, I mean, that's where we're heading,
okay,
right?
Okay.
So the basic idea is that if you are able to, for example, get somebody to behave a particular way, and then afterwards they look back at their behavior, they usually will tell themselves a story or justify themselves why they did it. Another way this kind of showed up is they would do like things like brain surgery, right? Mm-hmm. And they would like shock a certain part of the brain that would make somebody lift their hand and wave at somebody across the room, right? So completely involuntary behavior for the person who's being kind of stimulated with electrode in their brain to do this, right?
Wow.
And then afterwards, they would ask them like, oh, you waved at that person. Why did you wave at that person? And it'd be like, oh, they seemed friendly. I wanted to wave at them. Right. So they wouldn't recognize that the action was involuntary. Uh-huh. They would tell in their mind, they'd be like, oh, I did it voluntarily. And this is the story behind why I did this.
You know, I can actually think of a good example, like in real life where this happens, where I do this.
Yeah.
Right. When I'm on social media, for example, like on Instagram, you know, like the double tap, it's almost like a reflex move for me. If I'll know something within like 3 seconds or like a second, I'll double tap like, and I'll swipe away. I'll double tap like. And other ones, I'll just swipe away.
Yeah.
Other times, I'll just like swipe. But then if you then ask me, like, why did you like this post versus this other post? I would have to come up with a reason logically why I did, but I would totally be able to, oh, because I like the message that this person was saying. But I'm not actively thinking that logically while I'm double tap liking a post. Like, it's you just make these decisions of whether I like something or not like something based on how you're feeling,
especially with images, right?
Oh, we can
tell whether an image is pretty to us within fractions of a second.
Wow, fractions.
Yeah,
so not even a few seconds, just fractions.
Yeah, fractions of a second.
Wow,
which is a lot of times even on the advertising side, like a video is cool, right? Uh-huh. But video is limited in some ways by the fact that if it's a 30-second video, it takes 30 seconds for somebody to get the message.
Uh-huh.
But if you can craft a single image, you can get the message to somebody in 1/15th of a second, which is usually, like, you know, it's the amount of time that it takes for people to be able to process an image.
Interesting.
So if you can craft a very powerful still image, it could be sometimes just as powerful as a fully narrative video.
Well, I'm just thinking about, like, for example, even a thumbnail to a video. Like, people say, like, the thumbnail of a video is like 90% of the video in a lot of cases, because if no one's going to watch it, it doesn't matter what the content of your video is. But a lot of these thumbnails cater to that impulsive decision or emotions or the titles that triggers on whatever emotional impulse for you to actually watch something. And so, like, if we can learn how to manipulate, I guess, those emotions for people to actually watch a video based on just a still image, which is, for what you're saying, is probably the most, impulsive, kind of powerful method to communicate.
And so a lot of the stuff that we talked about in the last episode about glamour, right?
Mm-hmm.
Glamour is one of the, like, methods or techniques or ways of things that you can, tools you can employ in still image format to, again, have that kind of interesting, like, that stickiness, that magnetism to an image, right? Obviously, it's also the same reason why, like, you know, people use attractive models in things, right? You know, like, our brains are very, very fast in being able to, like, look at somebody and decide whether we find them attractive or not.
That's very true.
And so, again, that's one of the ways. And then, if you have competing brains, right? A lot of times, if you're in a room with a very attractive person, a lot of times your eyes will keep wandering over there, whether you like it or not, even though it might get you in trouble, right?
Yeah.
And so whenever we're playing these manipulation games, whenever we're doing kind of marketing, is that being able to think about the brain as these competing motivations and being able to press these buttons helps a lot.
And understanding that there's some weird impulsive competition in everybody's head.
Yeah.
And so if you tap into that thing that makes them like your video versus or like your image or, you know, follow you versus someone else's or click on anything, right?
Yeah.
An ad or, you know, click on buy now, whatever that triggers that, you can kind of tap into it.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
So on this kind of idea cluster of behavior happens first and then we tell ourselves a story about it later. Mm-hmm. A few things that come up that are kind of interesting and important to think about. So one thing, if you're any like psychology students taking psychology 101, mm-hmm. there's the famous Schachter-Singer experiment, which is oftentimes now talked about as an experiment that you're not allowed to do it because it's kind of illegal. But basically, they shot up a bunch of people with adrenaline without telling them that they were shot up with adrenaline.
Wow.
And then basically what they realize is that the way we read our emotions is that we have a physiological response. Right. So adrenaline, like an arousal. Right. Then we look around our situation and then we figure out, are we happy? Are we angry? Are we whatever? Right.
Oh.
So it's another way, in a sense, the behavior happens first and then the surrounding situation helps us figure out what emotion it is. So, emotion, one of the ways they teach emotion in psychology is that it's the physiological response times the cognitive understanding of what's going on in a situation.
Oh, wow.
So the difference between being afraid for your life versus afraid for your life because an attacker is coming at you or excited because you're going down a roller coaster is your cognitive understanding.
Oh.
So you're feeling the same physiological response.
You're scared, but then at one time you're enjoying it, and other time you're scared, literally legitimately running for your life.
Yeah, so basically with emotions, it's like one knob. Up or down of how essentially excited or aroused you are.
So basically adrenaline is literally there. It's a one, like two dimensional scale
of intensity
Right.
And then the rest is your cognitive understanding of what's going on.
So is there a way to then manipulate the adrenaline of somebody or by like an image or a video?
Well, there are, and we're definitely going to get into the topic of virality at some point in time. It's because, you know, the whole Jonah Berger contagious thing about how content that makes you angry is more viral, right?
Right.
And with all those different content types, right, the idea is that they can have the same level of kind of perceived emotional intensity, different kinds of emotion.
Got it.
The kind of how you read the emotion of the content changes whether or not you want to pass it along or not.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, but behavior happens first, and then we tell ourselves a story about it, right? And with emotion, the physiological response often happens first, and then we tell ourselves a story about that, about whatever that physiological response is.
Uh-huh.
And again, it could be a scary attacker coming at you, or you could tell yourself the story that you're excited by it, and you could actually shift what the emotion is in your head to the same physiological response.
So it's after the fact.
It's kind of after the fact. These weird kind of reverse things where we're looking back in time, and our brain sort of tries to tell us a story about like, okay, so like I just jumped out of a plane. This is exciting. This is fun, right? Even though it's the same physical physiological response you would have if a tiger was trying to kill you.
Wow. So the adrenaline level is up, but then you kind of like
tell the story
if it's dangerous or not.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The other reason why behavior happens first, why that idea is important, is that asking people what they want doesn't necessarily get you the truth.
Ooh.
And for marketing, that's very, very important.
Okay.
There's been many famous situations in the past. For example, when Coca-Cola tried to roll out new Coke, and they went, and then they went through focus groups, and they asked people, like, do you like this Coke? And everybody said, oh, we love this Coke.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
But then it turned out nobody wanted it, right? And so one of the things to kind of keep in mind when you're looking at people and at markets is that don't always necessarily listen to what people are saying. Paying attention to behavior is often more important.
Interesting.
It's a couple like ideas of how that kind of cup pops up. There's like that whole like high school cliche of like the girl, and she says she wants a nice guy, but instead she dates the guy in the motorcycle who like treats her badly.
That's a really good analogy,
right?
About
the
one side of the brain that's more impulsive versus the logical side,
right? Knows, so pay attention to behavior.
Interesting.
Not necessarily what people say.
So people can say, you know, like, oh yeah, this is I want this, but you shouldn't listen to that.
I mean, you, listen, but like, be wary.
Be wary. Right,
that oftentimes people say things, but it's more important to pay attention to how they actually behave.
Interesting.
Right. For example, in marketing, a lot of times people say they like choices.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But one of the things I've always tried to do is you always try to eliminate choice for people.
Oh,
because people say they like choices, but people hate making choices.
Yeah. Oh, that's
and
true.
So in like marketing situations, for example, if you have an e-commerce store, one of the things that is really good is being able to give the illusion of choice, but be guiding people in a way so they don't have to be making hard choices and the process is seamless.
Yeah, I do that all the time. And if there's like 12 different colors of something, I'm just going to sit there in the shopping cart and just be like, I don't know which one to get.
Right.
And so, I might abandon the cart later.
So there's a famous Henry Ford phrase, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when he was selling the Model T, you can have it in any color you want as long as it's black.
I love that.
Right. So, again, you don't necessarily listen to what people say. People say they like choices. But if you look at the way people behave in markets and in e-commerce situations, whatever it is, oftentimes people find making choices very stressful. And so you give them the illusion of choice in some way, but help guide them to be able to.
What are some ways to give the illusion of choice as an example?
Well, having a default.
Okay.
Is good, right? Sometimes if you have different packages, having one package like stand out more than others.
Oh, that's a good one.
Like, you see that on landing pages. Yeah.
You see on landing pages, there's like one big one. This is the best deal value. And then they'll like grade the other ones are like gray color in the background.
Yeah. Or, I mean, the other thing you could do is just have the other choices be terrible.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, they're just terrible deals. So, but it gives you the illusion of choice. Because who would take a bottle of, you know, vitamins? Who would buy one bottle for $100 versus three bottles for $120? You know, it's like, but it gives you that illusion that, oh, we're going to give you all these choices, but there's only one real choice that you should pick.
Yeah.
That's the best value.
It gives you the best value. Yeah. So people, again, they like the illusion. They say they want something, but you have to pay attention to their behavior.
Okay.
So one of the ways, the deeper parts of our brain tend to communicate with us, right? Because they don't have words. Again, for example, the non-dominant part of the brain in the split brain alien hand scenario can't use words because the dominant part is the one that tends to have the language.
Okay.
Because usually most of us have language stuck on one side or the other.
Uh-huh.
For a lot of us, it's on the left brain, but it can flip back and forth.
Okay.
So kind of some of those deeper parts of our brain tend to communicate to us through behavior. And I think in a lot of sense, one of the ways you can also put some of this to use, and I have this kind of theory, is that we can communicate back to them through our behavior.
Oh, really?
Right.
Okay.
And there's like a couple of things that comes to place. We talked about symbolic action in episode zero, right? About how, like, if you really want to do something, don't just tell yourself you're going to do it, but also do some sort of weird ritual.
Yeah, take action on something, doing push-ups against the wall every day.
You know, if you're going to go to the gym today, right, and that's like 8 hours away, commit to it by like doing a push-up against the wall or walking up the stairs two times.
Yeah.
Something super simple and silly. It doesn't have to be real, but you kind of take this symbolic action. Uh-huh. But the other way this kind of comes into play in a more serious way, and aficionados of marketing and influence, a lot of them have read this book. What is it? Influence, right? By Robert Cialdini, where he's a famous psychologist, I think from University of Arizona. And he has all these different rules about influence, and I'm sure this will come up on future podcasts. But one of the ones that I found the most, like, eye-opening is he has this idea of called commitment and consistency.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
And the two examples he gives in the book are one, he talks about POWs, I think during Vietnam, and about how if you take some small action that's easy to take that is in line with a particular identity, your identity starts shifting in that direction. And then with time, you want to be more consistent with that action. So in the POW context, the wardens of the prison were trying to get American soldiers to basically betray their country and betray the other POWs. And they would be very good at trying to get you to do something very small initially, right? That you think is not going to be a big deal.
Oh.
Right? And then slowly kind of build up on this. The other example Cialdini gives in the same book about the talk about commitment and consistency is, if somebody were come to your door today and ask you to put a huge political banner or sign in your front yard, chances are, unless you're super into this candidate or this party, you wouldn't do it. But if they come to your door today and ask you, can we put this little sticker on your window, right? And then they came back to you like 2 months later, the chances you would now put the bigger banner go up tremendously.
So it's, you just kind of start small, but because you're committed, you commit to something really small, a small act of action, right?
Right.
And then it's a lot easier then to gradually convince them to do something a little bit more and bigger.
What it seems to be doing is that it's the actual behavior or the language of behavior to communicating to your different parts actually communicates behavior change. Communicates identity change.
Okay.
So if you're somebody who, you know, starts doing wall pushups, all of a sudden in your head, maybe you're like, I'm somebody who's
fit and athletic.
Who's
worked
out
every
day. And then with time, you commit to some action. And then with time, you want to be consistent with the identity that comes out of that action.
I love that. Again, that's just a useful kind of like a mind hack where, hey, do you want to be fit? You don't have to work out, do 30-minute workouts. Just work out for like 10 seconds. Do two wall push-ups, you know, just to start off.
Yeah.
And just to start. And then, you know what, later on you could work out for a minute, and later on you could work out for 5 minutes a day, and that it can eventually turn to 10. Next thing you know, you're going to identify, you're going to change your own identity, right? From just being a lazy couch potato to, I'm actually a fitness guy now. You know, just by doing that daily gradual ritual to committing to something, it actually changes who you are.
Right. So behavior comes first, right? And then we start telling ourselves a story about it. And sometimes that story we tell ourselves about literally changes our identity.
Wow.
The way this can apply, for example, in the marketing context, is being able to make people take smaller actions.
Yeah.
Like somebody signs up for your newsletter.
Yeah.
Or
small
more
action, yeah.
It's a very small action. Yeah. They don't have to buy anything, but they're interested and they sign up for your newsletter, or you get them to follow you on social media.
Yeah.
A more kind of supercharged version of that is, let's say you somehow can get somebody to evangelize you, even without ever buying your product. Like, have somebody just write a review for you, or or talk about you, and all of a sudden they've put themselves out in front of their social circle as somebody who's supporting your product, your idea, your cause, and now psychologically, their identity is slowly shifting into being somebody who likes this product and very likely might actually use it.
Wow.
And so...
See, I love that. It's just trying to convince someone to take a really small action, which then leads to, you know, for example, you know, maybe a sponsor. Like, for example, like for a podcast, right? Let's say we want to find sponsors. We don't have to go after like Coca-Cola or like some sort of school, giant educational system wants to sponsor us. Just start like really small. Like, just find somebody. Hey, you know, we'll do it for free. You know, we'll market your psychology course or something, or your, you know, whatever you want, you know, just to get started. And all of a sudden that could snowball, that little action could snowball into other people being
or thinking about it this way. Imagine, okay, so you have somebody who doesn't want to be a sponsor, want to be a sponsor, but they're like a business person, right? And they hang out with other business people. If you can convince them to start talking you up in front of other business people, and they did not want to be your sponsor, and they keep talking you up to other business people, or whatever it is, their identity might slowly shift to the point where, because now they have to be consistent in line with what they're putting out into the world.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is a lot of ways how people actually change over time.
Wow.
Is, you know, you take some sort of action, right? Uh-huh. And like sometimes it goes in a good direction, sometimes it goes in a bad direction.
Uh-huh.
Let's say you're somebody, you go and you commit like a small crime, right? And now in your head, like, okay, now I'm a criminal, right?
Yeah.
Which makes it easier for you with your identity to commit.
That makes
another
so
one. So it's like
sense.
The slip. Another way they talk about it is called the slippery slope effect, right?
Yeah.
Right. Or it can go in the positive direction where you're somebody all of a sudden starts getting up in the morning and running 5 miles.
Yeah.
Right. Now all of a sudden you're a person who has leverage on yourself or something, right? And it'll start kind of bleeding into other parts of your life because you're somebody who's doing things. So communicating to the deeper parts of your brain through behavior, not just words, not through just pictures, seems to be able to actually help people kind of do these kind of behavior changes, right?
That is very cool.
In the marketing space, right, is getting people potentially take small actions, maybe talk you up, even though they're not putting any skin in the game. They're not taking their wallet out and paying for something. In an interpersonal setting, right, you know, this kind of might be a dark and manipulative way, right? Getting somebody to role play with you. So you, like, you've heard stories about, like, you know, actors and actresses like falling in love with each other. That happens all the time,
Sure it does, yeah.
Because they're playing out a role. You know, but if you have a, if you have situations where in some way you can get somebody to act as if something is.
So just the role playing, hey, like you see a pretty girl. Hey, let's just pretend we're on a date together.
Yeah, pretend.
Can I buy you a drink?
Hey, like I need to, I need to like impress my friends. Can you just walk in with me?
Oh yeah, yeah, that's a good one.
Right, and, but then you... you can walk away or whatever. But I just can you know walk in with me?
Yeah, yeah. Right? Hey, can you just text me
so I can get into this club or something?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
But like you know, acting as if, right? All of a sudden, in a little bit, if you're playing a role, at some point in time. You forget that you're playing the role and your identity starts shifting.
Interesting.
So behavior comes first and then we start telling our story about it afterwards.
That's great because again, like, because we're really communicating not with words, right? To that one side of our brain, we're communicating by behavior, right? Yeah. And so that's how we convince that other side to actually do something where we could then justify it logically with your dominant side. That's really cool.
Okay. So, main idea cluster one, I was kind of talking about, you know, this split brain and how the fact that we have competing brains, right? The other thing that kind of came out of that experiment is obviously seeing that, like, if you give information to the brain and get it to act a certain way, the dominant side afterwards starts making up stories to justify behavior.
Yeah.
Kind of the next level that's very interesting is what you're talking about, us making decisions based on emotion and then justifying with logic, right? And there's a gentleman named Antonio Damasio, who's, I think, at USC. But he did a lot of work with people who had, like, damage to their brain, where they had damage to the parts of the brain that deal with emotion. And one of the things he discovered is that if those parts of the brain that have emotion are damaged, people lose the ability to make decisions. So, like, it's like silly things like that. Do you want to have a ham sandwich or do you want to have a turkey sandwich?
They can't make a choice. Like, what color, like, iPhone do you want?
Like, that's like, yeah, but particularly like very silly things. So, that highlights the idea that we make most of our decisions before our conscious brain even becomes aware. We make them based on emotion.
So, there's a piece of your brain that actually does that. And so, you just have to be aware that it exists. It's real, it's a physical thing in your brain where. That's why you're making a decision, because that part of your brain sets to do that.
Right. And then afterwards, you kind of justify with logic.
That's crazy.
Which is kind of a really wild thing. And it sort of makes sense, because if you think about the way we interact with the world, let's say you're like you're a basketball player or you play piano or you do these complicated things. If you have to logically think about decisions, you would be a terrible basketball player.
Right.
Yeah, you'd be a terrible piano player.
Yeah.
Right. And so a lot of the things that we do are automatic and they're based on instinct.
Wow.
A common way to illustrate this to people is if you were tying your shoe and I came in during your process of tying your shoe and I interrupted you, you would not be able to restart the process.
Interesting.
You would have to go back to the beginning.
Yeah, just untie it and retie it.
Right, because it's such like an automated process, the idea of going from untied shoe to tied shoe, that it's very difficult for us to do it from the middle of the process.
Yeah, and I also like your sports analogy too, because that kind of, like, so many decisions in sports is not made by your logical side. You don't think about it. Like the greatest, you know, basketball players, you know, if you ask them, why'd you make that pass that led to the three-pointer to win the game? You know, they probably weren't thinking.
It's happening at such fast speed, right? Yeah. That it has to be basically instinct and muscle memory.
So it happens all the time when we make marketing decisions to buy stuff, to, like, do stuff. Like, you know, when we see an ad, to like something, to watch something.
Yeah, so the vast majority of our experience is automatic.
Wow. So right. That's so wild just to think about that.
Right. So as if we want to steer ourselves or if we want to steer others, you have to keep that in mind and you can start little domino effects to shift the huge ship in the right direction. But a vast majority of what we do as we just go through life is completely automatic. Because we've done it. It's all our habits. It's whether you put your sock on the right foot or left foot first.
Yeah.
It's like, again, we're making things, decisions based on these like kind of deeper parts of the brain.
Wow.
As a fun nugget, and I remember this because this is how I chose what college I went to. So we make decisions based on emotion, right, generally. But sometimes you get stuck in these situations where you can't make a decision, right? And if you want to, if it's a 50-50 choice, flip a coin. If you want to flip it again, it was the other one.
I like that.
It's the same reason why Ouija boards work, right?
Interesting.
Is that again, whatever, we have multiple competing brains and the Ouija board kind of helps us lead our hands to what we want.
It's like you
we want to admit to ourselves.
Yeah, you know what you really want subconsciously. What kind of color pants you want, you know deep inside. So I love that idea where you can actually tap into it, what you really want.
Yeah, you just have to. You have to force the choice, right? Because a lot of times, you know, your logical brain gets stuck in paralysis by analysis, right? So if you could just flip a coin, and if you want to flip it again, it was the other one.
That's so good.
And if it was the right one, then you're good to go.
I'm gonna use that. By our next podcast, I'm going to give you an example when I actually use that because that's such a good advice.
So behavior happens first, and then we tell ourselves stories about it. The loss of emotion takes away our ability to make decisions. To the point where, like, again, some of these studies that were done is that they were able to, like, put a person in an MRI and be able to figure out their decision before they consciously were able to make the decision by, like, a fraction of a second. Or like a second or something.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool. So, again, when you're out there and you're playing these manipulation games, right, if you're getting somebody to take the action or the behavior you want them to take, a lot of times it's happening not because of, like, the pretty words you wrote.
Yeah. It's based on emotion.
It's based on something else, right? And you have to find ways of communicating to those deeper parts of the brain, right?
Like, again, like just physical emotions. Like you said, like anger causes people to share things most out of all emotions.
Right. So like as a technique, and we use this a lot kind of in our office, it's something I learned from Spike, right? If anger is the most kind of shareable type of content, right? Creating a villain. By creating a villain, again, a lot of times what ends up happening, this is what causes most content on the internet to start eventually become toxic with time, because it becomes most shareable. It starts getting the algorithms to start feeding back on each other, and you know, get pretty dark pretty quick. But that is one of the buttons that you can sort of press.
So I'll give you an example, like just off the top of my head, how you could use that. Like, say you make shirts, right? But you're very environmentally conscious, right? You're like, everything's like organic and there's no, like, you know, things that'll give you cancer. Well, you just basically make villains out of everyone else who uses toxic ingredients in their clothing or like, you know, low wage, you know, people in third world countries and say, oh, look, they're just evil people versus us. Like, you just artificially create like this villain and people are getting mad, like, oh my God, like all these other companies are so awful. Like this is such a good company compared to everyone else. Like, but that tags in, that taps into that thing.
Your so emotion. It taps into that kind of that more primal side. Another variant on that, and American Apparel did this really well because they didn't have any marketing budget, is that they would create very controversial content that would get people angry.
Oh.
And they would share it on blogs and discuss it and hate on it. And they did this on purpose because they had a building, you know, here in Los Angeles where they were doing basically all their manufacturing. And so they had less money they could spend on marketing. And Ryan Holiday, who's the director of marketing there, very brilliant guy. He came up with this very controversial, very edgy kind of style of advertising.
So you can even make yourself your own villain.
Exactly.
As long as you trigger that emotional anger response.
You would create these ads that essentially would get people kind of angry at them.
Yeah.
And people would like start dissecting them on like feminist blogs and hating on them and whatever it is. And most people would have never seen these ads served like a normal ad, like on a billboard. They would have seen it as somebody else is commenting on, look at this crazy thing, like this awful, terrible thing American Apparel just put out.
So that's a guy who truly understood like that emotions will trigger a response. That's more important than, you know, the actual message or the image itself. Just triggers, just make people angry and people will start doing the work for you and spreading the news.
His first book, Ryan Holiday, it's we're going to go into it at some point.
Yeah,
it's called Trust Me.
Oh,
Trust Me, I'm Lying.
You told me
Confessions of a Media Manipulator.
Yeah, I read that. I've listened to it on audiobook. It's I mean, it's a little dated, but it's so relevant now.
Yeah.
Because he just talks about how he was able to just manipulate like these bloggers, like these low-end bloggers, to start getting like angry about stuff that he just basically fabricated, you know, himself.
Mm-hmm.
And the news just kind of, you know, start spreading from the lower bloggers to like major news corporations. Next thing you know, they're like, you know, on TV, like
defending themselves, right?
Yeah, getting booked for like interviews. Like, why are you so awful? Like, why is this? It's just so funny just listening to it.
No, it was basically he had this technique. It was called filtering up, where you would have one, you'd get one blogger to write about something, then you create a fake email account and send it to a different blogger who'd now write about how that blogger was writing about it. And then within a few days, he'd have like his client defending himself on CNN. Right? And you can't buy that kind of press.
Yeah, you can't buy that.
Anyway, Ryan Holiday uses a lot of very interesting, crazy tactics. He's definitely, I mean, he's a very brilliant guy, and he's definitely calmed down a lot. He writes now a lot more about like stoicism and like the righteous path. But in his early days, he was a rebel.
That's
and
hilarious.
That is a great book on marketing and media manipulation.
Yeah.
So I think, a good last thing to sort of get into, because there's a lot of smaller nuggets over time. We're sort of evolving this podcast. I don't really know what the format's going to be like with time, but a cool foundational thing to think about as how the different brains compete. I'll call this the battle of the brains. Is a friend of mine once upon a time explained to me the way the brain listens to music, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you can sort of divide up the brain is obviously there's the left and right hemispheres. But another way people do it that's very popular is to kind of the logical top brain, the deep reptilian brain, which is kind of all the kind of survival instincts, territory, sex, food, you know, reproduction. And then kind of the middle brain, the social kind of emotional, they call it the mammalian brain sometimes. And again, these divisions are kind of artificial, but they can be useful to sort of understand how the brain works. And I think thinking about how the brain listens to music can kind of help illustrate how these things compete against each other.
Okay.
And so, for example, the reptilian brain is very, very concerned about security, about safety, about predictability. And so one of the favorite kind of, if you reptilian brain listening to music, what it likes repetitive patterns that it can predict. So
like EDM club,
like EDM music,
like
something, you predict, or like repetitive guitar riffs, or things that like, again, if you think about most like music that feels very primal, it has some sort of very like
visceral
repetitive type of thing, right?
Yeah.
While kind of the logical type of brain that's more focused on like mathematics and language and pattern recognitions, right, would get bored, right, with something that repeats over and over again, right? And that part of the brain enjoys things that have like more harmony and chords, and like think like classical music and jazz and different
more
shifts,
cerebral kind of like melodies.
And so if you're just listening to like a repetitive drum rhythm all the time, right? You know, the reptilian brain's like, yeah, I love this, right? But the logical brain might start getting a little bit more like bored, like, oh, like, you know, this is not interesting to me. There's not enough novelty, not enough change, right? But on the other hand, right, I remember I went to this free jazz concert once. Uh-huh. Do you know what free jazz is?
No, no.
It's like jazz, but like even crazier. Like it's basically where like they try to throw all the rules out.
Okay.
And how uncomfortable it is to listen to this music. Like physically uncomfortable it is.
Interesting.
It's because, again, when things don't have patterns, when things are not predictable, uh-huh, a lot of like the reptilian brain, our survival mechanisms, like, can't make sense of this. And you literally sometimes have like a very crazy physical response to it, right?
Yeah.
And so I guess some people are a lot more into listening to crazy harmonic classical music and jazz. Some people are a lot more into like simple EDM music. Uh-huh. A lot of times those preferences might be about which part of the brain is more dominant in you at some point in time in your life.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that whenever we're playing these manipulation games, whenever we're thinking about things, we have all these different parts of the brain competing against each other. Uh-huh. And our goal, if we're trying to craft communication and trying to craft influence, is to be able to take all of them into consideration and find if we can give the right combination of signals to them to kind of appease the different masters.
So it's almost like, you want to piece a band together with a drummer and a bassist and a guitarist and a vocalist, but in your creative, you want the image to conjure up some sort of emotions, but you also want some sort of like logical kind of, thing that makes sense that ties everything together. So you want to use or understand that there's competing sides of your brain that are all attracted to different pieces of your marketing or your sell or whatever you want to promote, that you can tap into all three, basically.
Exactly, right? Because, it's very easy sometimes to tap into the primal sides of the brain, right? If you show somebody, if you show a very hungry person delicious food, their primal side of the brain will definitely react, right? Uh-huh. Especially if somebody's starving. Uh-huh. Sex sells. Uh-huh. That's why attractive models, Victoria's Secret, like most people when they see that, they can't look away because the primal part of the brain comes into play, right? Uh-huh. But at the same time, depending on what you're trying to, what kind of communication, what kind of influence you're trying to generate, right? Uh-huh. You have to find the ways of putting these different pieces together, uh-huh, right? To be able to kind of shift the person, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's one thing we can take from this whole kind of discussion about the competing brains is that it's very difficult to logic somebody into taking an action.
Okay.
Right. Behavior comes first.
Yeah.
And then people tell themselves a story about it. And so as we sort of, I think, evolve this podcast and, discuss these topics, we're looking at kind of dissecting these different tools that allow essentially us to go around the logical brain and kind of like create that crazy impact.
No, I'm already thinking about it. If I want to craft something that's going to get someone, you want to craft something that taps into an emotion that causes some sort of primal like anger, or something that causes triggers like empathy. And it's something that causes action that's very easy to like get into. I'm just thinking, those commercials where like, oh, you can donate to an orphanage or something. Mm-hmm. You're just like starving kids in Africa. And so you get angry that there's children starving. Mm-hmm. And then you have that empathy response. And then, it only costs me 25 cents a month to donate to feed a starving child. Then you tap into that kind of behavioral change that's so easy to make that decision. Next thing you know, it might be donating, $10 a month and $20. So it's like I'm just thinking about all these examples that people have already used in marketing that kind of tap into those three like parts of your brain, taking that action on behavior but making it so easy for people to make that behavioral change, to identify themselves as a philanthropist, for example, when they would have never thought that they were a philanthropist. Yeah. Next thing you know, you watch a commercial, next thing you know, you're donating $100 a month, So I love that practical kind of a takeaway from, just learning about these different behavioral kind of studies.
I think this will come organically, but eventually it'd be really cool to just give people a formula.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, we gave people, like, if you watch the Glamour episode, the last episode, go watch it.
Yeah.
There, like, we laid out a formula for how glamour works. Yeah. It's literally like a mathematical formula. Yeah. We show something interesting to people, right? You have to have some sort of element of the unseen, right? So people's mind can fill in the space and you tap into totems that already have cultural relevance to people, right? Yeah. So that's a formula, right? Uh-huh. So there's a lot of these different tools that I think we're going to dissect, and it'd be very cool at the end of it. So we have like a,
we should, you know what, we should package it up and sell it.
I mean, that'd be cool. You could turn this into a book.
We could. Yeah. And, you know, if you're watching a podcast, like, people are going to be listening. It's free. But, you know, that's how a lot of people make money. They give away something that's for free. And then next thing you know, it's like they're buying your course. So that's actually.
I don't think I ever want to teach courses.
Or
but
your book.
But, yeah. So I don't think we have all the answers quite yet. But I think as you stick with us, as we kind of work through and talk about these different tools and crazy phenomenon, like, the alien hand syndrome and glamour. We'll build something.
Let's just give it away. I love you know, giving this information to everyone who's listening. Yeah, because it's so powerful. It's like so practical. So I loved it. Anyways, thanks, Gene. I think that wraps up our third episode, second or third episode, however you want to define it. But I mean, I learned a lot. So thank you.
Cool. Thanks for doing this, Darren. This is so cool. I'm very excited.
I know. I'm so jazzed for a podcast. So anyways, for all of our listeners, thank you for listening. You can also find us on YouTube now. We have a YouTube channel. Yes. So you can actually watch us and see what we actually look like. And
it's more fun on YouTube, I think. Yeah, well, come hang out with us on YouTube.
All the glamour is going to disappear, though, because once they see us, they're going to be like...
Yeah, I guess we just need a freeze frame.
We need to hide our faces and...
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's again. Like if you ever watch a Jocko Willing podcast, he does it all in black and white. Very glamorous.
Wow, I love that. See, that's good advice. Well, anyways, thanks again, Gene. Thanks for listening or watching Manipulation Games, Psychology and Marketing. I'm Darren, and this is Gene Alder. Have a nice one. Bye.
Cheers, guys.